This CLE is based on New York State appellate decisions released in February 2020 addressing civil procedure issues. Summaries of selected decisions from February 2020 were posted on the New York Appellate Digest website. They've since been compiled into the February 2020 Civil Procedure Update pamphlet. It's that pamphlet which serves as the written materials for this CLE course. And the page numbers referred to in this recording are the pages of that pamphlet. First case is Matter of Cassini. That's Oleg Cassini on page 7. It demonstrates the severe consequences that can flow from not granting an adjournment to find new counsel. Second Department, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Shankman, reversing surrogate's court, held petitioner's motion for an adjournment to obtain new counsel should have been granted, and the appeal of the denial of an adjournment was not moot. The matter was before surrogate's court for an accounting in the estate of Oleg Cassini, who died in 2006. At the time of the request for an adjournment, three attorneys had withdrawn from the case. The trial went ahead without the presence of petitioner, that's Oleg Cassini's wife, Marianne, and without counsel for petitioner. The court wrote, "An appeal is not moot where the case presents a live controversy and enduring consequences potentially flow from the order appealed from. On the other hand, an appeal is moot unless the rights of the parties will be directly affected by the determination of the appeal and the interest of the parties is an immediate consequence of the judgment. Here, enduring consequences flow from the order appealed from, since absent a reversal of the order appealed from, the surrogate's court's determination after a trial in which Marianne did not participate will bind the parties." The surrogate was rightly concerned about the lengthy history of delay in this case, just as we are. However, there was no evident urgency that required the trial to start on July 25, 2016, as opposed to 60 days later, and any prejudice to the objectants could have been readily addressed by appropriate orders dealing with the administration of the estate and its assets. Next is Petruzzi on page 8. The issue is the amendment of a complaint to add a party after the statute of limitations had run. Second Department held the relation back doctrine allowed the amendment of the complaint pursuant to CPLR 1003 in this medical malpractice wrongful death action to add a doctor named Abergel, who treated plaintiff's decedent and was employed by the defendant professional corporation. The court wrote, "The causes of action arose out of the same conduct, the alleged negligence by defendant Perot and Abergel in the course of treating the decedent for her ulcerative colitis at the professional corporation's office, which they each did within the scope of their employment with the professional corporation. The vicarious liability of the professional corporation allows for a finding of unity of interest with Abergel, regardless of whether the actual wrongdoer or the person or entity sought to be charged vicariously was served first. The plaintiff satisfied the third prong of the test, which focuses on whether the defendant could have reasonably concluded that the failure to sue within the limitations period meant that there was no intent to sue that person at all, and that the matter has been laid to rest as far as he or she is concerned. The decedent's medical records from the professional corporation included several notes signed by Abergel, and clearly and repeatedly referenced Abergel as a physician who treated the decedent as part of the care rendered to the decedent by the professional corporation. In addition, the plaintiff demonstrated that the failure to originally name Abergel as a defendant was the result of a mistake, and there was no need to show that such mistake was excusable. Next is Alex Sanyan on page 9. It deals with the jurisdiction of the Court of Claims, Second Department. Noted that the jurisdiction of the Court of Claims is generally limited to money damages. Therefore, the action which was seeking a ruling that claimant's Verizon Lifeline service was wrongfully discontinued was properly dismissed. The court wrote, "The Court of Claims is a court of limited jurisdiction determined by the Constitution and statute. Its jurisdiction is generally limited to money damage awards against the state. Whether the essential nature of the claim is to recover money or whether the monetary relief is incidental to the primary claim is dependent upon the facts and issues presented in a particular case. Here, while the claimant alleges certain monetary losses, the essential nature of his claim is one seeking to compel the New York State Public Service Commission to investigate and issue a determination on his complaint that Verizon wrongfully discontinued his Lifeline service, which he alleges the Public Service Commission is required to do. The money damages sought are merely incidental to the primary question of the Public Service Commission's investigation and regulation of Verizon with respect to the Lifeline service program." Next is Dodson on page 10. The issue is how to handle a motion to dismiss when the action seeks a declaratory judgment. The Third Department, reversing Supreme Court in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Gary, in a matter of first impression, held a local law rezoning agricultural land as a senior living district where a senior living community could be constructed was invalid. In order to avoid the requirement that the local law be approved by a supermajority, as opposed to a simple majority, of the town board, the local law called for a 100-foot buffer between the senior living district and the surrounding properties. However, in this case, the land in the 100-foot buffer was to be used for access roads and other purposes which exclusively serve the senior living district. In that situation, the Third Department held, the approval of the local law requires a supermajority, and the local law was therefore invalid. The Third Department noted that because the complaint sought a declaratory judgment, dismissal of the complaint was not proper. A ruling on the declaratory judgment itself was required. Next is Arluck on page 11. It deals with what can be dealt with at an inquest after a default. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the court should not have considered issues of liability because defendant had defaulted and thereby admitted liability. The court wrote, "In this action to recover damages for personal injuries, the defendant failed to appear or answer the complaint. In an order, the Supreme Court granted the plaintiff's unopposed motion for leave to enter a default judgment against the defendant and directed an inquest on the issue of damages. After conducting the inquest, the court determined that the plaintiff had failed to establish that the defendant was negligent and that her negligence was a substantial factor in causing the plaintiff's injuries, and thereupon, sua sponte, directed the dismissal of the complaint. By defaulting, the defendant admitted all traversable allegations in the complaint, including the basic allegation of liability. As such, the sole issue to be determined at the inquest was the extent of the damages sustained by the plaintiff, and Supreme Court should not have considered issues of liability." Next is matter of Lila J.J. on pages 11 and 12, family court proceeding, and it deals with the proper way to analyze the effects of a default in family court. Third Department, reversing family court, held 1, the proper analysis of a default in this neglect custody proceeding is under Family Court Act 1042, not CPLR 5015 and 5511. 2, respondent was never notified of the fact finding, and 3, the default order must be vacated. The court wrote, "To begin, although family court and the parties assessed whether respondent was entitled to vacatur under the default mechanism of CPLR 5015 and 5511, the standard set forth by Family Court Act 1042 controls in this Family Court Act Article 10 proceeding. If a person legally responsible for the child's care has been notified of a pending fact-finding hearing and fails to attend, Family court is free to conduct the hearing so long as the child is represented by counsel. Respondent is such a person, and upon her timely motion to vacate the fact-finding order, family court was obligated to grant vacatur and reopen the hearing if she showed a meritorious defense to the petition, unless she willfully refused to appear at the hearing. It was an impossibility for respondent to default in attending a hearing that she did not know was going to happen and did not, in fact, happen. Respondent was further unable to challenge details of petitioner's evidence in the absence of a hearing, and the strength of petitioner's proof remaining a mystery, we deem the denials in respondent's affidavit sufficient to set forth a meritorious defense. Next is Bookman, the Bookman case, pages 12 and 13. It deals with a limited liability company's failure to let the Secretary of State know its current address and the effect of that omission on a motion to vacate a default. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held Defendant Limited Liability Company's motion to vacate a default judgment pursuant to CPLR 317 should not have been granted. Defendant had not filed its current address with the Secretary of State since 2011. The court wrote, pursuant to CPLR 317, a defaulting defendant who was served with a summons other than by personal delivery may be permitted to defend the action upon a finding by the court that the defendant did not personally receive notice of the summons in time to defend and has a potentially meritorious defense. Here, the defendant was not entitled to vacatur of its default pursuant to CPLR 317. The record reflects that since September 2011, the defendant has not filed with the Secretary of State the required biennial form that would have apprised the Secretary of State of its current address. See Limited Liability Law, Section 301, Subdivision E, thus raising an inference that the defendant deliberately attempted to avoid notice of actions commenced against it. In contrast to a motion pursuant to CPLR 317, on a motion pursuant to CPLR 5015, Subdivision A1, the movant is required to establish a reasonable excuse for his or her default. Under the circumstances of this case, the defendant's failure to keep the Secretary of State apprised of its current address over a significant period of time did not constitute a reasonable excuse. Next is One West on pages 13 and 14. It deals with a motion to discontinue when there's both a state and federal proceeding dealing with the same matter. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion to discontinue the foreclosure action should not have been granted with prejudice because there was no showing of prejudice on the part of the defendant, whose name was Jack. The plaintiff commenced this action seeking to foreclose the subject mortgage. After interposing an answer in which he alleged lack of standing as an affirmative defense, Jack moved for summary judgment dismissing the complaint insofar as asserted against him, and the plaintiff cross-moved for summary judgment on the complaint. The Supreme Court referred the action to a referee to hear and report on the issue of standing. After conducting a hearing, the referee issued a report finding that the plaintiff had failed to establish its standing for purposes of its cross-motion for summary judgment on the complaint. With this action still pending and the referee's report not yet confirmed, the plaintiff commenced an action in federal court seeking to foreclose the subject mortgage. Subsequently, the plaintiff moved before the Supreme Court for leave to discontinue the action without prejudice, which Jack opposed. The Supreme Court, in granting that branch of plaintiff's motion, which was for leave to discontinue the action, should have done so without prejudice. Pursuant to CPLR 3217, Subdivision B, an action shall not be discontinued by a party asserting a claim except upon order of the court and upon terms and conditions as the court deems proper. As a general rule, a plaintiff should be permitted to discontinue an action without prejudice unless the defendant would be prejudiced. Here, there was no evidence that Jack would be prejudiced by a discontinuance. Next is Lopez Lobo on page 13. Deals with a motion to dismiss a cause of action that's not recognized in New York. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's complaint should have been dismissed for failure to state a cause of action. Plaintiff was injured falling off a forklift platform. Plaintiff alleged defendants negligently destroyed or failed to preserve the forklift platform, thereby making it impossible to sue the manufacturer. The Second Department held that there's no such tort. The court wrote, here the plaintiff's sole purported cause of action seeks to recover for the negligent impairment of an employee's right to sue, which is, in effect, an allegation of spoliation. And New York does not recognize spoliation of evidence as an independent tort. Next is the Tax Equity Now case on pages 14 and 15. It's another motion to dismiss. First Department, in a comprehensive opinion by Justice Kern, reversing or modifying Supreme Court, held the complaint alleging the New York property tax system is unconstitutional should have been dismissed in its entirety for failure to state a cause of action. The court wrote, plaintiff does not adequately allege a causal connection between the property tax system and any racial disparities in the availability of housing. Plaintiff has failed to allege sufficient concrete facts or produce statistical evidence showing that the application of the property tax system, as opposed to other factors, causes financial barriers that inhibit the ability of minority residents to own homes. Additionally, plaintiff does not allege sufficient concrete facts or produce statistical evidence showing how the current property tax system contributes to higher rates of foreclosure or discourages the production of rental units in the majority-minority communities. Next is Matter of Sadie H.H., pages 15 and 16. It's a family law case dealing with the issue of forum non conveniens. The Third Department, reversing family court, held family court should not have ruled that New York was an inconvenient forum for a visitation slash contact enforcement petition, where mother is in New York and father is in Arizona with the child. The court wrote, as family court acknowledged, it had exclusive continuing jurisdiction over the matter pursuant to the Uniform Child Custody Jurisdiction and Enforcement Act. However, a court of this state which has jurisdiction under this article may decline to exercise its jurisdiction at any time if it determines that it is an inconvenient forum under the circumstances and that a court of another state is a more appropriate forum. The vast amount of testimony as to whether the father violated the order, which is central to the issue in this proceeding, will come from the mother, who is located in New York, and any witnesses that she may call. Any testimony from the father can be presented by telephone, audiovisual means, or other electronic means. Moreover, family court has presided over numerous proceedings between the parties related to this child. That court is far more familiar with the case than the Arizona court and is in a better position to interpret the meaning of its own order. Next is Albright on pages 16 and 17. Another inconvenient forum case. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion to dismiss on forum non conveniens grounds should not have been granted. 19 plaintiffs brought this products liability action alleging damages caused by defendants' Just for Men dyes and products. Only 2 plaintiffs resided in New York, and defendant's motion to dismiss was granted on that ground without any further proof. The court wrote, the defendants asserted no facts other than the non-resident plaintiffs were out-of-state residents. The defendants did not meet their burden of proof on the issue of convenience of the witnesses since, among other things, there was no statement as to whom the witnesses are and where they reside. Moreover, Just for Men's design, manufacturing, labeling, advertising, and executive decision-making all allegedly occurred in White Plains where defendant Combe Incorporated has a principal place of business. Further, there is no per se rule stating that out-of-state plaintiffs cannot, on the ground of forum non conveniens, sue in New York based upon products liability, despite the fact that evidence of damages would most often be found where the plaintiff resides. Next is Matter of Anthony F. on page 17. family court case involving a sua sponte ruling by the judge and the use of summary judgment in the context of a custody petition. The third department, reversing family court, held the judge sua sponte should not have dismissed father's modification of custody petition for failure to state a cause of action because mother did not request that relief. The third department went on to consider mother's motion for summary judgment and denied it. The court wrote, a motion for summary judgment may be utilized in a Family Court Act Article 6 proceeding, but such a motion should be granted only when there are no material facts disputed sufficiently to warrant a trial. In a custody modification proceeding, the controlling material fact is whether or not there is a change in circumstances so as to warrant an inquiry into whether the best interests of the children would be served by modifying the existing custody arrangement. Here, the mother failed to meet her initial summary judgment burden. There can be no dispute that only 5 months had elapsed since entry of the March 2018 order, and as such, the automatic change in circumstances provision incorporated in that order had not been triggered. The father, however, sought modification based upon several other alleged changes in circumstance, including that the mother had been disparaging the father in front of the children in violation of the March 2018 order, and that she is living in a homeless shelter. The mother, in her motion for summary judgment, makes no mention of these allegations or otherwise attempts to refute them in any way. Next is Deutsche Bank on page 18. Foreclosure case, another sua sponte act by a judge. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff bank's motion to vacate the default in this foreclosure action should have been granted. Supreme Court had sua sponte dismissed the complaint without affording plaintiff an opportunity to be heard. The court wrote, a court's power to dismiss a complaint sua sponte is to be used sparingly and only when extraordinary circumstances exist to warrant dismissal. As no such extraordinary circumstances were present in this case, we disagree with the Supreme Court's determination to sua sponte direct dismissal of the complaint without affording the plaintiff notice and opportunity to be heard, which amounted to a denial of the plaintiff's due process rights. Next is Al Rushaid Parker Drilling Limited on pages 18 and 19. It's a jurisdiction case, and it also deals with the concept of inconvenient forum. The First Department held that although using a New York bank for an allegedly fraudulent transaction is sufficient to acquire personal jurisdiction over out-of-state parties, it does not necessarily follow that New York is a convenient forum. Supreme Court properly found New York was not a convenient forum in these actions involving individuals and corporations in Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, as well as a Swiss bank. The court wrote, the court properly considered the following matters among others. 1. None of the parties to either action is a New York citizen or resident, or if an entity is formed under New York law or has its principal place of business in New York. 2. The alleged conduct at issue primarily occurred in the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Switzerland, with the sole New York connection being the fleeting presence of the bribery funds, at a non-party New York correspondent bank while en route from the United Arab Emirates to Switzerland. 3. The bulk of the relevant documentary evidence is located in the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Switzerland. And BVI, I guess that's British Virgin Islands. And most witnesses are located outside New York and beyond New York's subpoena power. 4. There is a likelihood that foreign substantive law will govern. 5. There are alternative fora available, Switzerland and the United Arab Emirates, with greater connection to the subject matter. And 6. In one of the actions, Switzerland has an interest in regulating the conduct of a bank operating within its borders. As Supreme Court correctly recognized, our state's interest in the integrity of its banks is not significantly threatened every time one foreign national affecting what is alleged to be a fraudulent transaction moves dollars through a bank in New York. New York's interest is in its banking system is not a trump to be played whenever a party to such a transaction seeks to use our courts for a lawsuit with little or no apparent contact with New York. Next is Stefaniak on page 20. It deals with the law of the case and appeals. Fourth Department, reducing the amount of attorney's fees awarded by Supreme Court, noted that a statement made by the Fourth Department in a prior appeal in the same matter was dicta and therefore should not have been treated as the law of the case by Supreme Court. In the prior decision, the Fourth Department stated that no one had questioned the number of hours the attorney, named Reedy, had worked on the case as the attorney for the child. Supreme Court took that statement to mean the number of hours could not be reduced by the court on remittal. Court wrote, "Our prior order unequivocally directed the court to calculate the amount of Reedy's fees. An award of attorney's fees must be calculated on the basis of the hours actually and reasonably spent on the matter by counsel, multiplied by counsel's reasonable hourly rate. In assessing the reasonableness of the hours spent by counsel, the issue is not whether hindsight vindicates an attorney's time expenditures, but whether at the time the work was performed, a reasonable attorney would have engaged in the same time expenditures. Thus, upon remittal, the court was to determine an award of attorney's fees that adequately reflected both the time spent and whether such time was reasonably related to the issues litigated." The court's statement in its earlier decision that no one has questioned the number of hours Reedy has claimed did not become law of the case. The doctrine of law of the case applies only to legal determinations that were necessarily resolved on the merits in a prior decision. Consequently, the doctrine does not apply where, as here, the court makes statements that are mere dicta. Next is Wells Fargo on page 21. It's a foreclosure case, and it just deals with the proof requirements on both sides regarding notice under the Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law. Second Department held that although plaintiff bank did not prove compliance with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law Section 1304, defendant also did not prove plaintiff failed to comply with the notice requirements. The court wrote, "Even in the face of plaintiff's failure to establish that a notice was properly mailed on a motion for summary judgment on the complaint, the defendant still has to meet its burden on a cross motion for summary judgment dismissing the complaint of establishing that the condition precedent was not fulfilled." So again, the failure of the plaintiff in this foreclosure action to demonstrate that it complied with the notice requirements does not automatically lead to summary judgment on that issue in favor of the defendant. Next is Rivera on page 23. It deals with the substitution of a party after the death of a party. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that plaintiff's wife, Jacinia, her motion pursuant to CPLR 1015 for leave to substitute herself for her deceased husband in this slip and fall case should have been granted. Defendant had settled the case and Jacinia was seeking payment. The court wrote, "Contrary to the Supreme Court's determination, the settlement of the action did not preclude the granting of a motion for substitution, citing CPLR 1015 subdivision A and 1021. The death of a party divests the court of jurisdiction and stays the proceedings until a proper substitution has been made pursuant to CPLR 1015 subdivision A. Without substitution as a party plaintiff, Jacinia may not seek relief pursuant to CPLR 5003-A. CPLR 5003-A provides that if the settling defendant fails to pay the sum due under a settlement agreement within 21 days of tender of a duly executed release and stipulation discontinuing the action, The settling plaintiff may, without further notice, pursue the entry of a judgment in the amount of the settlement, plus interest, costs, and disbursements. So the substitution in this case should have been allowed. Next is matter of Aiden O.O. on pages 23 and 24. Deals with several issues, motion to re-argue, the appealability of a order, and a sua sponte action by a judge. The Third Department, reversing family court, held the neglect proceeding should not have been dismissed without a hearing. The petition alleged mother was not providing ADHD medication to the children, and the children were unable to focus in school as a result. The Third Department noted that although the denial of a motion to re-argue is not appealable, here family court addressed the merits of the motion to re-argue and will be deemed to have granted the motion, making the order appealable. The court wrote, although generally no appeal lies from an order denying a motion to re-argue, where the court actually addresses the merits of the moving party's motion, we will deem the court to have granted re-argument and adhered to its prior decision, notwithstanding language in the order indicating that re-argument was denied. Considering that family court scheduled and heard oral argument on the motion to re-argue, and thereafter issued a decision addressing the merits, we deem the court to have granted re-argument, such that the December 2018 order adhering to the October 2018 order is appealable as of right. Next is matter of Chudowski on pages 24 and 25. It deals with the concept of res judicata, federal and state proceedings. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the dismissal of the action concerning overtime pay in federal court on the ground no notice of claim had been filed did not preclude the action in Supreme Court seeking leave to file a late notice of claim. The court wrote, the federal court dismissed the New York labor law claims for failure to file a timely notice of claim, citing County Law Section 52 and General Municipal Law 50-E. So much of the petition as sought leave to deem the late notice of claim timely served nunc pro tunc is not barred by the doctrines of collateral estoppel and res judicata. Although collateral estoppel precludes a party from relitigating in a subsequent action, an issue which was raised and decided in a prior action or proceeding, the issue of whether the petitioners could obtain leave to deem the late notice of claim timely served nunc pro tunc pursuant to General Municipal Law Section 50-E was not litigated or decided by the 2017 federal order. As the issue was not litigated, the petitioners are not precluded from raising it. Res judicata also is inapplicable to so much of the petition as sought leave to deem the late notice of claim timely served nunc pro tunc. Under the doctrine of res judicata, a disposition on the merits bars litigation between the same parties or those in privity with them of a cause of action arising out of the same transaction or series of transactions as a cause of action that either was raised or could have been raised in the prior proceeding. Since the federal court was without jurisdiction to determine whether the petitioners could obtain leave to deem the late notice of claim timely served nunc pro tunc, citing General Municipal Law 50-E, the petitioners are not precluded by the doctrine of res judicata from seeking a determination of this issue. Next is Turiano on pages 26 and 27. It deals with sanctions for failure to appear at a deposition. Second Department, reversing or modifying Supreme Court, held striking the complaint was too severe a sanction for plaintiff's repeated failure to appear for the continuation of her deposition. The court wrote, the plaintiff's repeated failure to appear for her continued deposition, coupled with her failure to demonstrate a reasonable excuse for that failure, supports an inference that her conduct was willful. The plaintiff proffered the health condition of her attorney as an excuse for failing to appear for the continued deposition. However, the plaintiff's attorney did not submit medical evidence or sufficient documentary facts to support the claim, or explain why his per diem attorney was unable to attend the deposition. Even so, given that the plaintiff had complied with disclosure except for completing the continued deposition relating to newly alleged injuries, we find that the striking of the complaint was too drastic a remedy. Next is City Mortgage on page 28, foreclosure case, dealing with some of the common issues that crop up in foreclosure, dealing with notice, for example. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff's motion for summary judgment in this foreclosure action should not have been granted. Plaintiff failed to prove compliance with the notice requirements of Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304. The court wrote, the plaintiff failed to establish that it complied with Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law 1304 because neither of the affidavits submitted by the plaintiff of two of its vice presidents asserted personal knowledge of the purported mailing, and neither vice president made the requisite showing that she was familiar with the plaintiff's mailing practices and procedures to establish proof of a standard office practice and procedure designed to ensure that items are properly addressed and mailed. The plaintiff failed to attach, as exhibits to the motion, any documents to prove that the mailing actually happened. Since the plaintiff failed to provide evidence of the actual mailing, or evidence of a standard office mailing procedure designed to ensure that items are properly addressed and mailed, sworn to by someone with personal knowledge of the procedure, the plaintiff failed to establish its strict compliance with Real Property Actions and Proceedings Law, Section 1304. Next is Bel Air Care Center on page 29. It deals with the criteria for a motion for severance. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendants' motions for severance should have been granted. The lawsuit was brought by healthcare employers against several insurance brokers to recover assessments levied by the Workers' Compensation Board for a $220 million shortfall in a workers' compensation trust. The court wrote, the Supreme Court improvidently exercised its discretion in denying those branches of the appellant's motions, which were pursuant to CPLR 603, to sever the action insofar as asserted against them. While all of the plaintiffs are seeking to recover damages pursuant to the same theories of liability, each separate plaintiff is asserting causes of action only against its respective broker with which it had a client-broker relationship. The appellants have persuasively argued that individual issues predominate concerning particular circumstances applicable to each plaintiff and to each appellant. In addition, a single trial of all the causes of action would prove unwieldy and confuse the trier of fact. Next is Wells Fargo, pages 29 and 30. It's another foreclosure action, this time dealing with the issue of the bank's standing to proceed. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held plaintiff bank did not demonstrate standing to bring the foreclosure action. The assertions that the note was in plaintiff's possession when the action was commenced were hearsay and were not supported by business records. The court wrote, the plaintiff to establish its standing to commence this mortgage foreclosure action of Amber Jurek, a lawyer with Gross Paloey. The plaintiff's counsel. Jurek stated that she was familiar with Gross Paloey's records and record-keeping practices. Jurek stated that on January 28, 2015, Gross Paloey received the plaintiff's file, which included the original endorsed note. Gross Paloey commenced this action on the plaintiff's behalf on February 26, 2015. According to Jurek, on that date, Gross Paloey, on behalf of plaintiff, remained in physical possession of the collateral file, including the original endorsed note, dated March 20, 2012. The plaintiff also submitted the note, which bore an undated endorsement to the plaintiff. However, Jurek did not set forth any facts based on her personal knowledge to support her statement that the note in the plaintiff's file was the original endorsed note. Further, the plaintiff failed to attach the business records upon which Jurek relied in her affirmation, and since Jurek did not state that she personally witnessed Gross Paloey receive the plaintiff's file, her statement is inadmissible hearsay. The plaintiff also submitted an affidavit of April Hatfield, vice president of loan documentation for the plaintiff. Hatfield stated that she was familiar with the plaintiff's records and record-keeping practices. Although Hatfield attached the records upon which she relied, she did not state that the plaintiff had possession of the endorsed note at the time the action was commenced. Rather, she relied on Jurek's affidavit for that fact. Accordingly, Hatfield's affidavit was also insufficient to establish plaintiff's standing. Finally, the plaintiff did not attach a copy of the note to the complaint when commencing the action. Therefore, the plaintiff failed to establish that it had standing to commence this action. Next is matter of McCrory. It's another standing case, this time dealing with municipal law. It's on pages 30 and 31. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, in a full-fledged opinion by Justice Rivera, held petitioners, as members of the public and residents of the village, had standing to challenge an alleged violation of the open meetings law. Petitioners alleged the village board did not provide proper notice of the meeting, improperly entered a closed executive session, and failed to accurately record the minutes of the meeting. The court wrote, "The open meetings law plainly confers upon the public the right to attend certain meetings of public bodies," citing Public Officers Law Section 100. "Consistent therewith, the harm or injury of being excluded from municipal meetings that should be open to the public is sufficient to establish standing in cases based upon alleged violations of the open meetings law." Next is Dookie on page 31. It's statute of limitations issue dealing with the continuous treatment doctrine, medical malpractice case. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's motion for summary judgment in this medical malpractice action should not have been granted. Although the alleged malpractice, the failure to follow up on a detection of a mass, occurred in 2006, the continuous treatment doctrine told the statute of limitations. A 1 year and 3 month gap in treatment did not preclude the application of the continuous treatment doctrine. The court wrote, "Plaintiff raised an issue of fact as to whether Dr. Wu continuously treated the decedent for conditions related to renal cell carcinoma. Plaintiff's expert, Dr. Feit, opined that Dr. Wu treated the decedent for symptoms of back pain, hypertension, and insomnia, all of which were symptoms of and related to renal cell carcinoma, a diagnosis that should have been considered given the findings of the 2006 MRI of a renal mass. Plaintiff sufficiently established that such treatment continued through the decedent's hospitalization in July 2012. The 1 year and 3 month gap between April 2011 and July 2012 does not preclude application of the continuous treatment doctrine." Next is Nation Star Mortgage on page 32. Another statute of limitations case dealing with debtor-creditor issue. The Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held defendant's trial payments as a condition for entering a mortgage payment modification agreement, called the plan, did not amount to an acknowledgement of the debt such that the statute of limitations would start running anew. The court wrote, "General Obligations Law, Section 17-101, effectively revives a time-barred claim when the debtor has signed a writing which validly acknowledges the debt. The writing, in order to constitute an acknowledgement, must recognize an existing debt and must contain nothing inconsistent with an intention on the part of the debtor to pay it. In order to demonstrate the statute of limitations has been renewed by a partial payment, it must be shown that the payment was accompanied by circumstances amounting to an absolute and unqualified acknowledgement by the debtor of more being due, from which a promise may be inferred to pay the remainder." While the writing arguably acknowledged the existence of indebtedness, the defendant merely agreed to make 3 trial payments so as to receive a permanent modification or offer. Any intention to repay the debt was conditioned on the parties reaching a permanent modification agreement, which condition did not occur. Next is Cannell versus Grail Partners on page 33, statute of limitations case involving a foreclosure. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held that installment payments due prior to 6 years before the action on the notes could not be recovered despite the allegation that the debt had been accelerated. The court wrote, acceleration causes those future installment payments that are not yet due and payable to become immediately due and payable. It enables the lender to advance the due date for the future installment payments, and thus the statute of limitation runs on the balance of the debt. It does not change the due date of those past due installment payments to that of the date of acceleration. Defendant demonstrated that the unpaid installment payments due prior to 6 years before the action began were time-barred. Next is Vitali versus Astoria Energy. On pages 34 and 35, it deals with the criteria for a directed verdict. Second Department, reversing Supreme Court, held questions of fact for the jury precluded the directed verdict pursuant to CPLR 4401 for the defendants in this labor law section 200 action. Plaintiff was working as a surveyor at a construction site. He was walking across the rebar grid when one of his legs fell through. There were questions of fact whether walking on the rebar grid was an inherent risk of his job and whether the grid was a dangerous condition. Plaintiff's motion to set aside the directed verdict pursuant to CPLR 4404 should have been granted. The court wrote, in directing a verdict in favor of the defendants on the issue of liability, the Supreme Court improperly decided the factual questions of whether traversing an uncovered rebar grid was an inherent risk in the injured plaintiff's work as a surveyor, and whether the uncovered rebar grid was a dangerous condition under the circumstances. The record demonstrates that the plaintiff's evidence made out a prima facie case and that disputed factual issues existed which should have been resolved by the jury. Since the court failed to draw every favorable inference in favor of the plaintiffs, and because the court resolved disputed issues of fact, the matter must be remitted for a new trial on the issue of liability. Next is the Natalie case. Another motion to set aside the verdict, page 35. The First Department held Supreme Court properly set aside the verdict, awarding nothing for pain and suffering in this labor law, section 240, subdivision 1 action, despite plaintiff's failure to object to the verdict as inconsistent. The court wrote, plaintiff's failure to object to the jury's award of nothing for both past and future pain and suffering as inconsistent with the jury's awards for past and future lost earnings and future medical expenses did not preclude the court from deciding whether the jury's failure to award damages for pain and suffering was contrary to a fair interpretation of the evidence and constituted a material deviation from what would be reasonable compensation. Next is the Thomas case on page 37. Another motion to set aside the verdict case involving the award of zero damages. First Department, reversing Supreme Court, held the damages verdict awarding nothing for future pain and suffering should have been set aside. The court wrote, the jury's award of damages for past pain and suffering deviates materially from what would be reasonable compensation, citing CPLR 5501, subdivision C. Plaintiff sustained an ankle fracture and underwent 2 surgeries, the first involving implantation of hardware in the ankle, the second involving arthroscopy and removal of the hardware and some scar tissue. Comparing this matter to similar cases, we find that $275,000 is reasonable compensation. The award for future damages also deviates materially from what would be reasonable compensation, again citing CPLR 5501C. Defendant's expert agreed that plaintiff's injury is permanent and that he has developed arthritis in his left ankle, which may require treatment in the future, including the possibility of an ankle replacement. In light of the foregoing, we find that $100,000 for future pain and suffering is reasonable compensation. At this point, I'm going to insert the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this February 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE. The verification code is ANKLE. Again, the verification code to be placed on your attorney affirmation for this February 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE is ANKLE. The final case is Matter of Sean M.M. on pages 37 and 38. It's a family court case, and it just deals with the requirements for a petition for visitation and contact. The Third Department, reversing family court, held verification of a visitation petition is not required by the CPLR, that's CPLR section 3020, or by the Family Court Act Article 6. So again, a visitation petition need not be verified in family court. And that concludes this February 2020 Civil Procedure Update CLE.